Thank you, Your Honor. Your Honors. Good morning. May it please the court. I'm Dan Hedlund, and I'm appearing today on behalf of Appellant Shalia Smith. Ms. Smith filed her appeal pro se, briefed it, and then I was appointed by this court through the Minnesota chapter of the Federal Bar Association's Pro Se Project to represent Ms. Smith, and I'm pleased to appear here in that role today. We filed a supplemental brief. An appellee filed also a supplemental brief, which is before the court. Before I begin my argument, I just wanted to draw the court's attention to my client, Ms. Smith, who is seated in the front row there. Ms. Smith, who now resides in North Carolina, traveled here by bus on a 27-hour trip to come to the argument. So a little bit of pressure for me. This court is obviously aware of the that it reviews this case de novo, and I'm sure it's heard the summary judgment standard more than it's care to have heard it. But I do think it's important to remember that in employment cases that this is really something that should seldom be used, and only in those instances where there is no dispute of fact and where there exists only one conclusion. Based on all the facts viewed together in this case, this is not such a case. There are genuine issues of material fact which should allow Ms. Smith to have her case heard by a jury of her peers.
What's your strongest argument here? What's your best shot in your view?
Well, with regard to, I think the hostile work environment is the strongest claim. As the court's aware from the district court's ruling, the judge broke it down into three different types of claims, ruled that six of those incidents were plausible incidents of racial harassment, and then dismissed three others as not being sufficient or plausible. Of the six that are that the court found to be plausible, unless the court has questions about them, I won't go into them at this time. But I do think that there are others that the court dismissed, I think, improperly and didn't consider that should be viewed as plausible incidents of discrimination. First was an incident involving something that occurred in the break room where Ms. Smith brought in a dish, which was a fish-based dish, and she indicated that it was an African dish. Now, when the district court looked at this, it just said there was a complaint about smelly fish, and so there's no racial animus there. But in her testimony, Ms. Smith clearly indicated that she had indicated it was an African dish, and the response that she got was Africans eat fish heads and they do this and they do that, and so I think there clearly was a racial component to that incident. There was also an incident which the court appears to have accepted as being racially based, although when it counted up at six it didn't add it in, which was where another employee after Ms. Smith walked by her said that she should go back to the ghetto where she came from, and that was in the Tayana Jackson deposition. And then the other two that I think the court overlooked and it shouldn't have was one where there was an incident of another Fairview employee who approached a volunteer employee that Ms. Smith had been speaking to, who was a Somalian, and indicated that a conversation they had been having about food and about how the volunteer could get a job at the hospital as being inappropriate. Now, the racial connection there, other than the fact that Ms. Smith and the volunteer were both African-American, or in the case of the Somalian, was that previously there had been an incident where Ms. Smith alleged that Ms. Gennare had been on the website getoffended.com, which the court clearly found contained very vile racist comments. And Ms. Smith had reported Ms. Gennare to her supervisors. In appellant's view, Ms. Gennare coming up and then commenting to them that their conversation was inappropriate is an attempt to intimidate or harass her as a result of having reported her. And then the last incident is the incident involving the onion, which I imagine the court's read about, but essentially Ms. Smith's fellow employees, who were all white, showed her a screenshot from The Onion where African Americans were sitting on a porch after Hurricane Katrina and were essentially being belittled by the caption to the photo. All these incidents that occurred, which we believe are approximately 10 incidents, were not dealt with appropriately or were ignored. And I think if you look at it as we believe it should be viewed, you have 10 separate incidents of racial discrimination over a 12-month period. In the Woodland case, there was found to be no hostile work environment, and in that case, there were about 7 incidents that occurred over a period of 4 to 5 years, compared to the Reedy case, where there were about 7 incidents in 7 months, and hostile work environment was found. And I think the Bowen case also supports appellant's claim in terms of the frequency of the incidents of harassment. Furthermore, when the district court dismissed this claim, it said that it didn't rise to the level of the Jackson case, where a hostile work environment was found, and in that case, as the court I'm sure is well aware, the court reversed an earlier decision after there had been some connection drawn between the plaintiff's name, a KKK symbol, and a burning cross. I think this. If that is the bar, I think it's too high because it almost suggests that a death threat of some sort is required in order to establish a hostile work environment. Quickly, with regard to retaliation, I think there's a lot in the record to suggest that there are some factual disputes as to when certain things happened. The court found that the temporal connection between the protective activities and the retaliation was not that strong. I believe that it is strong because if we're looking at 10 different activities over a period of 12 months, I think you could look to any one of them as being the cause for the retaliation in the two different corrective action notices.
Let me ask you something. I think of all the allegations or incidents, I think at least arguably the Get Offended, is that the name of the website?
Yes, Your Honor.
Incident may be the most severe. Now, the appellee responds that appropriate corrective measures were taken in response to the complaint by Ms. Smith. What's your response to the fact that they argue that they took action?
Our response is absolutely not. There's a couple points on that, Your Honor. One is they did an investigation where they went to the two employees, Matthew Banyai and Tracy Gennari, and they said, did you look at a website that had T-shirts on it? But they never asked, what website did you go to? And then the corrective action taken was, there's a policy at Fairview that you're not supposed to view non-work-related websites in the workplace. They never said anything about, did you look at a website called getoffended.com? And they never said, it's inappropriate to look at non-work-related sites, but I believe they should have said it's really inappropriate to look at this type of vile, terrible things in the workplace, and especially in the situation where they looked over at Ms. Smith and motioned for her to come over. I think there's a couple other things that suggest that that Fairview was not properly set up to deal with these situations. Although she changed her testimony at the end of the deposition when the HR rep, Ms. Hawk, was initially asked whether or not they had a policy against employment discrimination. She testified that she didn't. Pat Poussard, who was Ms. Smith's supervisor, claimed that she had never taken diversity training and wasn't sure why Fairview would want to prevent racial discrimination. So I think there's a lot in the record that suggests that they have not adequately responded in that instance and in all the other instances, because I think the response in the other instances is very much the same. Just the last point before I'll sit down and reserve the rest for a rebuttal. In terms of the constructive discharge, I think if you read the Kimsey case, which holds that if an employee quits because she reasonably believes there is no chance for fair treatment, there is a constructive discharge. There's two things that I think support that. One is the testimony of Melissa Sharp, who was a white employee at Fairview, who was asked at her deposition whether or not she thought Ms. Smith could receive fair treatment or as fair treatment as a white employee at Fairview could. Ms. Sharp responded no. And I think further, the record is also replete with many instances where Ms. Smith applied for several jobs to get into a different department at Fairview and was turned down for them and rejected from those positions in large part because there had been corrective actions filed against her. Ms. Smith, in an email to conclude, stated, "I am feeling that there is no way for me to advance in my career decisions, only being allowed to be a transport aide. There's no room for me to grow here, leaving me stagnated." I think she tried to raise these issues with her supervisors. She went through the proper channels, spoke to her direct supervisor, spoke to the HR folks, and in the end, nothing was getting done. And in fact, the behavior continued. And I think in the end, she felt there was no way she was going to get a fair shake.
If I may ask the question on Fairview Ridges Hospital, is that a freestanding unit that runs independently of all the other Fairview hospitals that are possibly around, or is it all big one interconnected company?
Your Honor, I do not know the answer to that question, although I suspect Mr. Kelly could answer it. I do know that in the emergency department where Ms. Smith worked in Burnsville, which is a suburb of Minneapolis, she was one of two African Americans out of 100 employees. But
The total employment at that facility was 100?
In the, how I understand it, right, in the emergency department, 100 employees with two African Americans. Thank you very much.
We'll next hear from the other Daniel, Mr. Kelly.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name is Dan Kelly. I represent Fairview Ridges. Fairview Ridges is part of the Fairview system, which is the broader system in Minneapolis. I want to start right out of the gate by correcting some of the comments in factual responses that were given by counsel. Specifically, starting out with, he makes the point about the fish incident. And I can't do better than to read directly from the testimony of plaintiff as to what occurred there to demonstrate that this was not at all an incident that evinced any racial animus. I'm looking at page A34 of our initial appendix, her deposition testimony. But there were maybe something that was said about my food, some food that I had gotten an African friend to make for me. And we were sitting in the cafeteria, well, not in the cafeteria, but the break room, and one of the nurses walked in and said, "What is that I smell?" And myself and one of the nurses was sitting there eating, and she said, "Did somebody put fish in their food?" And then the nurse that I was sitting with said, "Yes, Shalia's dish has fish in it." And her response was, "I smelled food that smelled better than that crap in my garbage." Right, that's the incident. It does not evince any racial animus. There's no way that employee walking into that cafeteria could know that Ms. Smith had an African friend make the food for her. Simply put, fish that's cooked sometimes smelled. It did in this incident, but that's not a racial incident. But this is part of a pattern, not only a pattern of how the case has been argued in the brief at our oral argument, but the manner in which Ms. Smith engaged in employment and considered things that happened to her during the course of her employment. Another example would be this incident with the onion.com, which is a parody. If you would look, and you know, I'll just cite to it, on page A72 of the appendix is her contemporaneous description of what occurred. And I'm not going to read it aloud because the words are somewhat offensive, but you'll see in reading that on page A72 that she brings race into the picture, that it's clear that the article itself does not mention it, and she, in responding to her employee that was viewing that picture, allegedly, she brought race into the picture. It was only at the time that she filed an EEOC charge, which is at A53, that she misquotes the Onion.com article, because at the point she put the EEOC article in, nobody had the actual article. So she misquoted it and included an explicit reference to race. But upon investigation, we found the Onion.com article, which is at A138, and it has no racial language whatsoever. At most, it's a sexually harassing or sexually offensive caption or cut line under the photograph, not dealing with race. She also, appellant claims in her brief that there was an incident in which someone asked her, because she could speak Spanish, whether or not she was Puerto Rican. She characterizes that as being a discriminatory action in her brief before this court. I'll read from her deposition how she characterized it when I deposed her under oath. And one of the nurses says, "Are you Puerto Rican?" And I said, "No, I'm black. Look at me, I'm black." Because I just got tired of her asking. She'd asked in 3 times within 30 minutes, and I said, "I'm black. I'm from America. I'm black." And everybody just started laughing. Everybody laughed. I even laughed at it because I'm like, you know, what's so odd about me speaking Spanish? Now, whether or not somebody asks somebody else's nationality in the workplace is civil behavior, appropriate behavior, or not, what it isn't is illegal behavior or a behavior that evinces racial animus. It's that type of mischaracterization, both in the record and, frankly, at the workplace, that caused these incidents to be considered by Ms. Smith as being racial. But if you look to the record, they are simply not racial. And so what the court did at the district level was take and itemize these issues, determine, separate the, if you will, the race-related wheat from the non-race-related chaff, came up with six incidents, and looked at those incidents, and looked at them through the spectrum that is dictated by this court, namely frequency, severity, whether they were physically threatening and humiliating, and determined that those incidents did not rise to the level that this court requires to demonstrate that racial animus permeated the workplace and was extreme in nature and was both objectively and subjectively hostile. What the district court found is that there were six incidences sprinkled throughout a 12-month working period. She actually took a leave of absence. That 12 months does not include the leave of absence, none of which was from supervisors, none of which, no racial animus was directed at her. She overheard some comments, yes. There was a characterization in oral argument that that there was a comment about her, about appellant returning to the ghetto. That was reported to appellant by a co-worker. Appellant didn't even herself overhear that. And it's not to say...
What difference does that make in your view? Offensive, race-related comment that the appellant is subjected to, whether it's reported or whether she hears it directly, it still comes to her attention.
I absolutely...
What's the difference? I'm curious about that.
I agree that it is race-related. I agree that it's offensive. The difference is how it plays into the severity and whether or not it is individually humiliating because she was not subjected to it in person. But I think it goes to severity and for the most part. And again, I'm not defending that individual action. I do think it's offensive and it ought not to have occurred. But an isolated comment from a non-supervisor that's not directed at the plaintiff, that does not include the boorish and crude and severe language that we see in some of the other cases is not sufficient to rise to the level of it permeating the workplace and being extreme in nature.
No, I was a little confused about this bulletin board incident. Was the picture, would it have been a fair assumption for the plaintiff to assume the picture that was on the bulletin board of the of the birthday bulletin board, that was directed at her?
It wasn't a birthday bulletin board. It was a bulletin board where people would put up their childhood pictures and people would have to guess who they were. There's a dispute, and it's covered in Ms. Poussard's deposition, as to whether or not that related to an individual named Theo, another employee in the department, or whether or not it related to Ms. Smith. Obviously, Ms. Smith believed that it related to her. She believed that it was an incident that related to her. It was early on in her employment, I believe in May, sometime of 2005. So, again, I would call that a dispute as to whether or not it related to her or not.
Would it make a difference if there are only two African-American employees in the department, whether it was directed to her or whether it was directed to the other African-American employee?
Would it make a
difference? Wouldn't she be almost, well, maybe you're saying she wouldn't be quite as offended if it was the other employee, but still wouldn't it be offensive?
I don't think I entirely agree. She could construe that as being offensive, and I don't think it makes a significant difference as to the weight. If the court would determine that that's an offensive situation, then the court would weigh it as such. And in fact, the district court did. The district court saw that and said that does give rise to an inference of a racial animus. But taken in the totality of the circumstances as compared to the other cases, what we don't have is any type of animus or direct racial epithets from a supervisor or even a co-employee directed at her. We certainly do not have any kind of physical threatening behavior. And counsel mentioned, and I think it's worthy to note, the Jackson case. This court has said that the Jackson case presented a situation that was on the cusp of submissibility, that's the yardstick. Counsel indicated that he felt that if that was the yardstick's too high. But the fact of the matter is that is the yardstick. That's the yardstick this court has used to measure these cases. And that involved it was a case that was initially summary judgment was affirmed, and it was only tipped over to submissibility by having a threatening arrow pointing in KKK, physical threatening type of behavior to the plaintiff in this case. This situation does not get close to that. This situation is much more akin to the O'Brien case, which is not a race case, but the Singletary case, the Carpenter case, those types of cases.
The employer here, though, did provide the chalkboard and presumably all the things that go with that to make this possible, right? I mean, this isn't something that the employees dragged in and said, aha, let's have a cute little story here to tell. This is done on hospital property, on facilities owned by the hospital.
The picture of buckwheat?
Well, not the picture necessarily, but what it was on and how it got up there and how it got pasted. I thought it was on a chalkboard.
It was on a bulletin board, and any employee could put their own picture or a picture up on that bulletin board. As part of this, people guessing who they are on their childhood picture. Yes.
What did the hospital do anything in reaction to any of these incidents?
Yes, and I am glad the court asked that question. This getoffended.com, which I think the court recognized, is the most significant issue, and certainly the district court considered it to be an overt act of discrimination. But we really need to dig in the details to figure out the level of seriousness there. First of all, it was two co-employees, certainly not supervisors. And they were looking at a website, allegedly. I should point out, they deny that they looked at any such website, but that all that does is cause a fact dispute. We have to assume the facts in light most favorable to Ms. Smith. Two employees looking at this website. Counsel indicated to this court moments ago that those employees motioned to plaintiff or to appellant. That's absolutely incorrect. They did not call her over. They did not motion her over. In her deposition, she said that they invited her over with their eyes and their laughter. Right, so they did not affirmatively involve her in this situation. Secondly, She looked at the website, she claims, and was offended by it and said such. She then quit looking at it, went back home later that day, and spent 20 to 30 minutes looking at the website on her own at home. And that's where she fully explored what was on that website. So, although it was an overt, and it is an offensive website, I'm not going to defend the website, it's an offensive website, what did Fairview do in response? They questioned the employees denied it. They then went to their IS department, had a complete search done of those computers. We produced the search. The IS person who conducted the search was deposed in this case. They couldn't determine. They could not prove that those employees had looked at it. So what you have is one employee claiming something against another employee, and you have no proof as to who's correct or not. Nonetheless, they went to those two employees and verbally advised them and reprimanded them that in any case, they cannot look at non-work-related items on the website, on the Internet site. So it's absolutely incorrect to say that they did nothing wrong. Now, Ms. Smith's response is, well, they didn't get fired. Well, it's black-letter law that the complainer doesn't get to dictate precisely what occurs. It's that they have to take some action, and they did. I note that my time is almost up, and I want to make one point on the retaliation claim, and I apologize that I'm not going to be able to address it in more detail. But one of the claims that is made is that the November corrective action, which she undisputedly knew about the issues in August, resulted from or in retaliation to her to plaintiff complaining about the previously mentioned fish incident. But I would direct the court to her deposition, specifically at A34. At A34, in her deposition, A34 and 35, I said, did you tell Pat Poussard, your supervisor, the supervisor who ultimately issued the corrective action, about the fish incident? She said, no, I told Kathy Bratvold. So appellant is attempting to claim that I told one person, and yet a different person issued a notice of corrective action, even though the person that issued the notice of corrective action, there's no evidence that she even knew about the first incident, and somehow that's retaliation. I also want to comment on the fact that the temporal proximity here is an absolute stretch. The September 7th issue of TheOnion.com and her report about the September 7th issue is supposed to have resulted in a November 15th corrective action. That's 2.5 months. You have to work very hard to call that temporal proximity. And once you work that hard to call it temporal proximity, that's all you have. There is no other evidence. And again, it's well settled within this court that temporal proximity is not sufficient. Your Honor, on behalf of Fairview Ridges, we'd ask that this court affirm the district court's entry of summary judgment. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Kelly. Does Mr. Hedlund have additional time?
Yes, Your Honor. He has possibly
2 minutes. 2 minutes?
Thank you. Just quickly on rebuttal, a couple of things. One, in terms of the fish incident, later on in that deposition, there's a question about, was there anything in the comment about the fish that would lead you to believe that it was motivated by race, which she responded, no. Then she said, there was a comment that I made in reference to being an African dish. So Africans are usually black in origin. So by me stating that it was an African dish, then I can only believe that she was making a reference to it. In terms of the bulletin board, Theo, who was the other African-American employee in the ER, already had a picture up on the board. So, and in addition to that, Ms. Smith had just had her hair braided, and so the thought is that it was intended to look like her. But I agree with the court that even if there hadn't been up another picture, there's still only two people out of 100 who are African-American. In terms of the bar being too high, I think there are cases that this court has found a hostile work environment where there haven't been what I view as being tantamount to death threats. For example, if I think the Diaz case, if that's looked at, you'll see that a hostile work environment was found there, and I think there are similarities to the case here. In terms of the O'Brien case cited by the appellees, I know at least Judge Malloy, you were on that panel, and perhaps you too, Judge Shepard, so I think you're well aware of the facts there, but I think if you compare the facts in that case to what has happened in this case, they are not similar. In that case, it was determined that there was not a hostile work environment, but I think it's much less than what's been shown here. Lastly, Ms. Smith did file an EEOC charge, and the EEOC did determine that there was fraud, or I'm sorry, did determine that there was hostile work environment and retaliation, which I know is not anything you have to listen to, but I just wanted to point that out. In terms of the IS department looking for that one website, which they could not find, I'll take that as what it is. The only other thing about what happened with the IS department, which I think is curious and worth noting, is right before Ms. Smith filed her EEOC complaint, her email files were deleted, and there's an email at S34 which talks about that. And as a result, she was unable to obtain certain information to bring her claim. That's all I have, unless the court has anything further.
I guess that will do it, Mr. Hedlund, and we appreciate your service here this morning and the presentation by both of you. We will render a decision in due course, and we thank you for your attendance.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The next case, Madam Clerk.